Yeah. How we doing? Well, welcome to round two of our vision series titled The Church. Throughout this series, and basically what we're going to be doing is taking a deeper look at Severn's mission to be a church where people grow in faith, find their passion, and fulfill their calling as followers of Jesus. And so what this effectively means is when people become a part of what Jesus is doing at Severn, we want to see individuals, we want to see families, we want to see people grow in intimacy with God, we want to see people grow closer to God, we want to see people come to grips with why God made them and what God has called them to do, and then ultimately we want to see people walk out a life of obedience to the call that God has on their life. Can I get an amen? Are we good with that? All right. So through the month of August, we're going to unpack our ministry model, our come, see, stay, grow, go model. We're going to unpack a portion of that each week. And in essence, that model represents Severn's DNA. It represents Severn's approach to life as followers of Jesus. And so last week, Pastor Ryan kicked off our series and he walked us through week one, which was come. And in that sermon, what we heard about is our rationale behind why we should gather corporately to worship God. And what he told us is that we come together to be challenged, to be encouraged, and ultimately to be reminded of what Jesus has done to reconcile sinners to God and make them saints. And so this morning we're going to open up the second component of our model. And this aspect of our model is it's what we want people to see when they show up here at Severn Covenant Church, when they show up here at 20 Gambrels Road. And in essence, it's this, that every time someone occupies this pulpit, every time a message is disseminated from this pulpit, it is our earnest desire that we are allowing people an opportunity to grow in intimacy with God, that we are allowing people an opportunity to see their lives, their circumstances, the lives of other people, to see absolutely everything through the lens of the gospel. We want to center everything that we do here at Severn on the gospel, our relationships, our work, our families, our finances, the way that we love our spouses, the way that we engage with people of other from other cultural or racial backgrounds, the way that we treat people who disagree with us, the way that we view politics and religion and anything under the sun. We want the gospel to be the lens through which we interpret the world around us. Because here's the scoop as far as our creed when it comes to the gospel. We are convinced that the gospel is the singular thing that can change absolutely everything. It is the gospel that has the power to change us from the inside out, making us into the people that we are supposed to be, that we want to be, the people that we should be. And so this begs the question, and the question is simply this: what is the gospel? What is the gospel? And I've heard people say all kinds of things with regards to the gospel. I've heard people say the grand old punchline is like, I shared the gospel with someone, or I gave someone a gospel tract, or I preached the gospel. The question that's always coming up in my mind is, what do you mean by that? What are you talking about when you say that you preached the gospel, or you shared the gospel, or you heard the gospel? Because to us here at Severn, the gospel is the linchpin of Christianity. It is the everything. It is the one thing that we can hang our hope on. It is the one thing that can absolutely change and transform us. And so, in a basic sense, here's what the gospel is. In a very basic sense, it's the message of how God saves sinners. It's the message of how we have been rescued from peril. That's it in a basic sense. And so in other words, think of it like this. The gospel is good news, not good advice. The gospel is good news, it's not good advice. The gospel's not a way of life. It's not something that we do. We don't do the gospel. The gospel is something that's been done for us. It's something that's happened to us. And the gospel is a message that we've got to respond to it. And the only viable response to the message of God reconciling sinners to saints is humility. That is the only viable response to what God has done. And so when we think about the gospel, we can think about it like this. And this is how a theologian by the name of D.A. Carson puts it. He says, because the gospel is good news, it is to be announced. That is what one does with news. Preaching is bound up with the fact that the core message of Christianity is not a code of ethics to be debated, and certainly not a systematic theology to be outlined. Though it properly grounds ethics, it teaches us how to live, and though it gives us systematics when it comes to theology, it is neither of those. It is news, and therefore it must be publicly announced. And so simply stated, every 7 days at Severn, we publicly announce the gospel. The good news that Jesus, despite our broken relationship with God, despite our internal brokenness, despite the brokenness of our relationships with other people, despite all of that, Jesus came to make our relationship with God right again. He came to change our status before God, because we in and of ourselves could not change our status as sinners before a righteous and holy God. And apart from that, there is absolutely no hope for us. The gospel is not, it's not some sort of divine rehab program that has 12 steps to a new you or a brighter future or a better day. The gospel is simply this, that in Jesus, sinners like us can be fully rehabilitated. It's the news that we have been moved from death to life. It's the news that outside of Jesus, we were fully broken. It doesn't matter where you hail from or what rules you've been following. Outside of Jesus, absolutely every one of us is fully broken. It's the news that in Jesus, absolutely every one of us, regardless of what you've done, can be made fully clean and fully whole. So, if what Jesus has done, it's not based on status, it's not based on your background or your ethnicity or your, you know, the religion that you grew up in or the church that you hail from or your socioeconomic status or any of that, because it's not based on merit, at least it's not based on our merit, it's based on Jesus' merit, because it's not based on anything that we've done, the only way that we can understand the gospel is it's a free gift that God is giving to us in Jesus. And because it's not based on anything that we've done, we can think of it as this. It's something that is completely accessible to everyone. It's something that you cannot earn, so it's accessible to absolutely everyone. If it were based on some qualifying standard, that would mean that the gospel is for some people, but it's not for others. And the gospel, my friends, it's for absolutely everyone under the sun. And so today, we're going to take a peek at chapter 2 in Paul's letter to the Galatians. We'll look specifically at verses 11 through 21. And my primary objective today is to do nothing other than to introduce you to the gospel of Jesus, to show you that it stands alone as the central aspect, the central message of what it means to follow Jesus. It's the central message of Christianity. And maybe you're thinking, well, you know what? You guys do this every week, or I've heard the gospel a million times. Can't we get on to deeper aspects of theology? Can't we study a more systematic theology? Can't we get on to topics such as holiness and how I'm supposed to live? Well, hear me out. I am convinced that there is not a deeper theology out there than the message that God saves sinners. And so the gospel, it's not the first step in following Jesus. It's not just for non-believers or new believers or baby Christians or whatever you want to call them. And as we find out today, what we're going to see is that the gospel is for the seasoned veteran who forgets. We're going to meet Peter, who he's been following Jesus for years, preached on Pentecost. Thousands come to faith in Jesus as a result of what he's doing. And we're going to find that one of his friends, namely Paul, one of his friends in the gospel is saying, Peter, You have forgotten the gospel. You're not applying it. You're not applying it in your own life, and you're not applying it in the lives of the people that you come in contact with. So I'm in Galatians 2. We're going to cruise through verses 11 through 16. But before we get there, I want to give you a little context, a little background, if you will. And so here's the skinny on what's going on in the church. We got a beef in the church, and it's between two camps of people. And there's a bit of racial tension in addition to the theological beef, or the debate, rather, that's going on. And what we're going to find is two very distinct groups with two very distinct motivations in following Jesus. And on one end, the people that we run into, they're culturally Jewish. These are people who grew up going to synagogue. They're Jews by nature. They're Jews ethnically. And they're propping up a form of the gospel that says this: yeah, Jesus paid it all, but it's our responsibility to uphold the letter of the Jewish law. And until we do that, we can't be validated before a righteous and holy God. And they're not just telling that to themselves, they're telling that to Gentile believers. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have Paul, and he's simply declaring that God came to us in Jesus, completely fulfilled absolutely every letter of the law, so that in Jesus we can be fully justified. That because of Jesus' finished work, we are qualified, we're justified, we're loved, we're accepted, we're in. God has welcomed us home in Jesus, and it has nothing to do with anything that we've done. And so you can think of the way that the Jewish Christians in this case are following Jesus like this. They're saying Jesus plus adherence to Jewish law equals everything. And when I mean everything, I mean salvation. And then you have Paul who's saying, no, it's Jesus plus nothing equals everything. And again, when I say everything, I mean salvation. And so what the Jewish Christians are saying is there's something that you and I have to do to be loved and accepted by God. And here's how that plays out, because it plays out. It played out then and it plays out now. Here's how that plays out when we prop up our belief in Jesus and we hold it up based on a bunch of rules and regulations that we're supposed to follow or things that we're supposed to avoid. We get a little tense. And some of us get a superiority complex with the way that we live up to those rules. And if we're adhering to the rules, we feel really, really good about ourselves. And we feel like we have a green light to tell everybody how bad they're doing. And in so doing, we kind of feel better about ourselves because we're saying, you know what, I'm not like them. I'm not doing that. And you feel qualified because of your effort. You feel qualified because of the things that you're doing. And you easily disqualify other people because of the things that they're either doing or not doing that are inconsistent with what you think people should do as followers of Jesus. And so we become religious moral police in a sense. And that's what's happening with the Galatian church. You got religious moral police that are justifying their existence by saying, look at how well we live up to the letter of the law. And they're condemning everybody who's not meeting that criteria. And it might be like this. They might see somebody whose life is coming unglued. The hinges are falling off, the wheels are falling off the proverbial wagon. And what they do is they kind of put the burden on that person and they say, well, if they weren't so sexually immoral, or if they didn't spend so frivolously, or if they didn't decide to do thing X, Y, and Z, their life would be markedly better. And so the burden is put on that person. And basically what the religious person is saying is, if you just change those three things that you normally do to these three things, your life's going to be better. And the big question that they routinely ask, and these are religious people, these are the people that Paul is addressing, is what's wrong with those people? And in this case, they're asking that question, and they're saying there's something so wrong with Gentiles, we don't even want to do lunch with them anymore. We're not willing to have them at our table. We're just downright rejecting them. I'm sorry, that's bad news if you ask my opinion. And so I think the big thing that religious people, these Jewish Christians, people who are following a code of ethics as a means of gaining God's love and acceptance, I think the big thing that they're grappling with is they don't understand grace. They can't understand grace because they're too busy trying to prove themselves. And you've all been there. You know that when you work hard for something, you hold on to it. You don't freely give it away. It's yours. You feel like you earned it. Nobody can take that from you. Some of us won't even let people use our stuff because we feel like we earned it and maybe they're going to mistreat it or not treat it as well as you would. And you look down your nose and you're like, there's something wrong with those people. I got to stay away from them. And so here's what I think we can glean from this. Religious people, they make judgments based on like this idea of religious superiority. So they're the best, everybody else is the worst. The other thing that I think we can glean from this is that Paul is making a clear distinction here between the gospel and religious practice. And he's not talking about the ins and outs. Because here's the thing, both types of people in this setting, the Gentile believers and the Jewish believers, they both go to church. They both worship together. They pray. They're doing the same. They're reading the Bible. They're doing the same things. But what is markedly different from one group to the other is the motivation, the why behind what they're doing. And the distinction is this. This is what Paul is saying, that the gospel, it's not a set of rituals or procedures or rites that you're going to perform to help us gain God's love and acceptance. The gospel, because we're already loved and accepted by God, motivates us to good works. We're saved to good works, not by good works. So we're motivated to be generous, to be compassionate, to forgive people that have hurt us. Because we're already loved and accepted by God. So ultimately, Paul is saying, Jesus plus nothing. And this is a hard one. You're like, what am I supposed to do? Do nothing. Jesus plus nothing is everything. And we're not saying do nothing. What we're saying is the doing comes after. The doing comes after that point of reconciliation. You can't earn your keep with God. God rescues you and then he says, hey, this is the life you're supposed to live. Go and do that. And ultimately, Paul's main message here is that the gospel is good news, not good advice. And here's what we read in chapter 2, verse 11. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For he regularly ate with the Gentiles before certain men came from James. However, when they came, he withdrew and separated himself because he feared those from the circumcision party. Then the rest of the Jews joined his hypocrisy so that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were deviating from the truth of the gospel, I told Cephas in front of everyone, if you, who are a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you compel Gentiles to live like Jews? We who are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners know that no one is justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. And we have believed in Christ Jesus so that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law. Because by the works of the law, no human being will be justified. So the gospel, it's good news, not good advice. And it's news about what Jesus has already done. And again, like we might be thinking, well, what about holiness? What about turning people from sin? What about turning from the sin in our own lives? Paul's not leaving that out. Later on in this passage, he talks about like living in sin as a follower of Jesus. That's not something that we're called to do. We're not called to do that. But here, Paul is arguing the starting point. He's arguing all the points along the way that in Jesus, you are fully justified and fully reconciled to a righteous and holy God. Because here's the thing about Jesus. If you haven't figured this out, he is going to ask more of you than anyone ever will or anything ever will. But the difference is he starts by giving you everything and then he asks you in return to give everything. So look at your justification, your righteous standing before a holy God, as it's like this unending bank account. Like you can never stop withdrawing from it, and that's the only way. That is the only way you're going to hammer out this thing called sanctification. That's the only way you're going to engage in good works with the right motivation and the right mindset, is realizing that Jesus saw you broken and he came and rescued you. You were fully broken and now you've been fully restored. And it's nothing that you've earned. It's not anything that you've done. It's something that God has done on your behalf. And so here's what's going on. And I think it gets really, really interesting if we look at Paul, his address to Peter, because he could have very easily said, and mind you, Peter is being kind of racist. He's being racist. He's of one ethnic group and he's looking at another ethnic group and he's saying, I can't even eat with you guys anymore. Like he's pushed them out. It's us versus them at this point in time. Peter is engaging in racism. Paul could have easily said, hey, Peter, squash the racism. Just have lunch with these people. He could have easily said that. He could have easily just cracked a spine on an Old Testament and said, Peter, look, let me tell you where God condemns racism and how it's wrong. He could have easily done that. But Paul is not interested in engaging Peter's mind. Like that's not going to get him to where he wants to go. Paul engages Peter's heart. He engages Peter's motivation. And ultimately, what he is saying, in lieu of addressing Peter's superiority complex, what Paul is saying is, Peter, you have forgotten the gospel. He's saying, Peter, do not forget that the gospel is the end to our desperate search for validation, self-justification, for worth. He's saying, Peter, Jesus fulfilled the entirety of the ceremonial and the sacrificial laws that you're using to condemn other people. He's saying, Peter, if everything hinges on what we do, on what we accomplish, we're all going to lose. If we're only worthy of what we work for, we don't stand a chance. The anxiety will never end because we're always going to be wondering, is this enough? Am I doing enough to earn my keep? Our selfishness will never be overcome because we're always only going to be earning our keep for ourselves anyway because we're trying to get out of the mess that we're in. And so just to clarify this a little bit more as far as what our dilemma actually is, Paul writes a letter to the church at Rome. And the backdrop or the background that he has in mind when he pens this letter is Genesis 3. And in Genesis 3, if you were to turn there, what we read about is God's curse on the entire created order. Like everything is broken, everything. Like that dog that you really love, it's broken. Like everything about creation is messed up. And there's nothing that we in and of ourselves can do about it. And because we're alienated from God, and like ultimately that's the crux of the problem. We're alienated from God. But because of that, we're psychologically alienated from ourselves. And that's why we get scared, and that's why we get fearful, and that's why we grope for coping mechanisms to make ourselves feel justified and valued and worthy. The other aspect of our alienation is socially. Like we're just socially alienated from each other. This could be genders. This could be races. This could just be people in general. For some of us, it's the people in our own homes. Here's the reality of the matter. Because we're alienated from God, we're actually physically alienated from nature itself. And there's a reason why, for some of us, our cheeks are starting to sag. Gravity is clearly winning, and ultimately we're gonna breathe our last breath. We're gonna die. We're headed towards death. But in Jesus, death is not a destination, it's a doorway that we get to walk through. But in the meanwhile, we're gonna experience sorrow and pain. Our work's gonna drive us crazy. people are going to aggravate us. We're going to get angry. We're going to bout with sin. And the reality of the matter is, I think every person has some sense, some deep sense of the fact that something's wrong. Like something is wrong with us. Something is wrong with the people around us. Something is wrong with absolutely everything. And so because of that deep sense of something being wrong, we have a deep sense of emptiness, and we're in constant pursuit to fill that emptiness. And we fill it with all kinds of crazy. We fill it with sex. We fill it with material goods. We fill it with substances. We fill it with broken relationship after broken relationship after broken relationship. We fill it with work. We fill it with money. We fill it with power. We fill it with whatever we can grab that's going to make us feel validated and justified and worthy. And so Peter and the circumcision group, they're coping with their sense of emptiness with religion. And what they're doing specifically is they're looking at the rules and regulations of religion and the adherence to those rules and regulations as a means by which they're going to justify themselves. They're looking at differences in people, racial differences, linguistic differences, cultural differences, and they're saying, you know what? Let's call those out. Let's make fun of that to make ourselves feel better. Let's condemn people so that we feel better about our own existence. And I'll just share a little something with you, because I heard something like this in my home just yesterday. And I have some kids at home. I have a few kids at home. And whatever. Don't laugh at me. I have 5 kids, for those of you that I haven't had the pleasure of meeting. Just yesterday, one of my older children said to one of their younger siblings in a dialogue they were having about the future, my 5-year-old says something to the tune of, "When I grow up, I want to be a mom." So we're like, "That's amazing. That's cool. That's a good goal. Be a mom." We'll talk about, you know, how to get a husband, and you know, we're on that or whatever. And the 6-year-old is like, "You don't even know how to read. How are you going to be a mom?" All right. So this 5-year-old, she just turned 5. She's never been to school. So we're like, unless she knows something more than we knew when we were 5 or whatever, like, why would she even know how to read? But the point that I'm getting at is, like, my 6-year-old is making that remark because she hears something that she feels like she's got to compete with. And so to validate herself, she's like, "Ha, I already know how to read. You don't. Ha, ha." And that's literally what happened. So you got one child in tears and the other one that has a smirk on their face. And I'm just sitting there like, what? There is something wrong. Like, something is wrong in this house. But we do the same thing as adults. And I'll tell you something that happened to me this week. A guy, I crossed paths with him. He's homeless, right? He told me he hit a rough patch. He's been sleeping in his car for 2 months. And here's where I went mentally. And track with me. Maybe you've gone there. And if you haven't, good job. So I'm sitting, he's telling me a story, saying, "I lost my job, I hit a rough patch, I need gas money, I just want gas in my car because I have a job interview on Monday." He proceeds to show me an email that he got from a potential employer. He proceeds to say, "Hey, listen to this voicemail." And all the while, he's just justifying the fact that he's valuable is what he's really doing. And in the back of my mind, I'm just thinking, he's probably lying. Tell me you haven't been there. You see the guy on the corner and you're like, "No, I can't give him the 20 spot because he's going to drink it or smoke it or do whatever with it." So on one end, this guy's trying to justify that he has value, because when he's sleeping at night, he's sleeping in a car. He doesn't feel valuable then. He's lost all of the societal and cultural markers that we describe as successful. And all the while, I'm just sitting there, I'm totally judging him. Now, mind you, I worked through it. All right, I worked through it, and we talked for a while. We talked church, we talked gospel. He told me he was a believer, and I just asked him at one point in the conversation, I said, "When you came in here, did you feel like you had to justify yourself to me?" And he said, "Absolutely. That's why I pulled out my phone. That's why I showed you the email. That's why I told you I have a suit, and I was willing to show it to you, suit hanging in the car for the interview." And I was like, "All right. Why did you feel like that? Because if you are following Jesus, which he told me he was, you have no business justifying yourself. You are already valuable." So we made our way to the gas station. We filled his tank, and, you know, we hugged and exchanged some words. And then I don't know if I'll ever see the guy again. But that for me was, wow, do I even understand the gospel? Do I understand the implications of the gospel and what it means when I'm interacting with people like this guy who I looked at through a lens? And when I saw him, it wasn't through the lens of the gospel. It was through the lens of, well, you know what? Everybody's a secret con artist. And I was like, and he is good. He's got emails and voicemails. But another way that this plays out is, look, I'm up here preaching a message, and I could easily say, you know what? I'm preaching for God, and I'm preaching for you, but at the end of the day, there is part of me that wants to be successful. I want to preach a message that makes sense, that generates excitement and intrigue, and I want to preach a message that results in people that I respect coming up to me at the end and saying, hey, that was great. I want a pat on the back. And so the question is, like, who am I doing this for? Because I'm already justified. I have no business looking for a pat on the back. Although it's great, and I'm not saying we shouldn't encourage each other, because we should. But we should never be engaging in anything for the applause, because we've already gotten the applause in Jesus. He's already said, welcome home. He's already said, you're completely justified. And so ultimately, as people, we want to matter. We want to be valued. We want to be accepted. And when we don't feel that way, we want to justify our existence, and we're willing to do whatever it takes. Because one of our deepest fears is that we don't matter. I think as human beings, we're scared of that. We're scared of not mattering, not being valued. And I think I have an idea as to why that's the case. For some of us, we've actually been told that. You've been told by way of what someone literally said to you or what people in your life have done, that you do not matter. Some of us feel like we don't matter because we're like that guy who lost his job. Everything that I was using that made me feel good about life, and I'm not saying don't feel good about your work, but everything that I was using to feel a sense of self-justification and value is gone. I'm unemployed. My marriage is falling apart. My kids, I don't even know what they're doing. They're just out there somewhere. Maybe they'll come back. I'm hopeful that they'll come back. But right now, I feel like a failure as a parent. Some of us feel this way because we're not the right color. We don't feel like we fit in. Some of us feel this way because we cannot shake that addiction that we've been wrestling with for our entire adolescent and adult life. Some of us feel this way because we've been abused by the church, we've been burned by religious people. And I'm just here to say this, that our drive to prove ourselves, here's the root cause of our drive to prove ourselves. Because all the problems we face, all those scenarios I just described, those are just symptoms to the root of the entire problem. Our separation from God is the cause of all of this. It's the reason for all the misery, all the shame, all the guilt, because the entire created order is cursed as a result of sin. And so, the first and primary focus of human rescue has got to be something that saves us, something that restores us to a right relationship with God. And Paul tells us in verses 15 and 16 that no one, regardless of what you're trying to do, can fix it themselves. It's not a matter of avoiding bad behavior and engaging in good deeds. That is not going to fix our right relationship with God. Because all of us are equally broken and equally unclean. But he's telling us that in Jesus, all of us can be equally made whole, be made equally clean. And so ultimately, the gospel is the good news about what Jesus has done to make right our relationship with God and to restore absolutely everything that's been ravaged and destroyed by sin. And so what Paul is ultimately saying to us, church, is that the gospel changes absolutely everything. And in verse 19, here's what he says. For through the law I have died to the law so that I might live for God. I have been crucified with Christ and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God, for if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died for nothing. Hear me out on this, church. The gospel changes absolutely everything. And it's the message that the moment you put your faith in Jesus Christ, you are immediately justified. There's no wait time. There's no lag time. There's no, oh, maybe next week, maybe next year, maybe when I nail those four things that are really good for me to do. None of that. You are immediately justified as a result of Jesus' finished work. And so what that means is you are crucified with Christ. So when Jesus hung on the cross, here's what that was like. God saw Jesus as if Jesus had done everything that you and I have done. And when Jesus was raised from the dead and seated in glory, now when God sees Jesus, he sees us as if we've done everything that Jesus has done. Are you tracking with me? Jesus took what we deserved, and he gave us freely what he deserves. God treated Jesus as if he were us, and he treats us as if we were Jesus. That's the gospel that changes everything. In Jesus, because of the gospel, we are fully loved and fully accepted. And we see a picture of how the gospel is capable of transcending every barrier and changing absolutely everything. If we take a peek at how Jesus interacts with the Samaritan woman at the well, and mind you, this is a very similar scenario as the one that we're dealing with in the church, the Galatian church. You have cultural tension. Jews and Samaritans don't really hang out. Jesus has no business even talking with the Samaritan woman, but he's tired. He's traveling through Samaria. He asks her for a drink, and she wants to know, why are you asking me for a drink? Jewish people don't even talk to me. And then there's that layer of it, the gender differences, where Jesus is not even supposed to be having this conversation with a woman that he's not really familiar with. He's talking to a woman in public. And not just any woman, this woman has a scarlet letter. She's been in relationship after relationship after relationship. They've all failed. She's currently in another relationship. She's not married. And Jesus is talking with her, a Jew who's very familiar with Jewish law. He's very familiar with what Jewish law has to say about marriage and relationships. And he reaches right through that. He's very familiar with how he's supposed to interact with her because of who she is. And he reaches right through that, and he gives her hope in a hopeless situation. And here's how the exchange plays out. When Jesus and this woman are talking about drinking water, ultimately what happens is Jesus gives her the skinny on water. And he says, look, this well that you have, I don't care who you are, I don't care how much you drink from it, ultimately it is never going to quench your thirst. And he says, but I, however, have water that will quench your thirst forever. And what Jesus is saying is, I want to show you what the answer to all of your questions. I want you to feel fully satisfied in me and in nothing else. The woman wants to drink the water, but Jesus goes deeper. And he says, go and get your husband. And the woman's like, I don't even have a husband. And Jesus knows everything about this woman. I don't have a husband. And he says, I know. And the man that you're with is not your husband. She's breaking the law, right? I mean, we got people like that in this day and age. They're shacking up together. We don't look too kindly upon them. We don't apply the gospel the way that Jesus is applying the gospel. And I'm not saying you should wink and be like, oh, that's okay. But I am saying there's a way to approach people. And Jesus approaches this woman markedly differently than church folk would. And she tries to change the subject. She's like, let's talk theology, Jesus. Let's talk about where people are going to worship. And Jesus is like, no, let's not talk theology, because I have something bigger in mind. And it's deep internal change that will change everything for you. Jesus wants to fulfill the deepest longing of her heart, the deepest longing of our hearts. He wants to give her something that will provide the deepest level of satisfaction, worth, and value. Because here's the reality. The gospel is the only thing it's never going to leave us empty. It fills us and it changes us from the inside out. And maybe you feel like, I can't change. It's the same day or different day, same problem. I'm still wrestling with the same thing. My wife and I still have the same problems. Whatever the case may be, you feel like you can't change. Some of us have been seeking love and acceptance and trying to self-justify for a long time, and we're stuck there. We've been abandoned by the people that we needed the most, and that hurts. Our mistakes are too big, our sexuality's too wrong, our problems are too massive for us to change. And here's what the gospel says. It says, stop. Stop believing that. Stop believing that there's a solution outside of the gospel. Stop trying to justify yourself with another relationship or another whatever it is that you do to try to justify yourself. Whether it's a substance, whether it's your job, whether it's your finances or your possessions. The gospel says stop. It says we can't make it on our own. And because we can't make it on our own, Jesus made a way for us. At Severn, we don't want the starting point for people to be the religious rules or what we believe, how we're supposed to live based on what the Bible says. We don't see that as a starting point for our interactions with people. We're not here to convince people of a bunch of rules and regulations. That's not step one in following Jesus. We want people first and foremost to see the power of the gospel in their own lives, in the lives of the people around them. Because only the gospel can change the way that you behave, can change the motivations of your heart, can change the way that you engage in your work, the way that you love, the way that you forgive, the way that you do absolutely everything. Only the gospel can change that. Only the gospel can change the way that you look at people who are different from you, who don't hold the same political views as you, who don't pursue the same things as you or have the same ambitions as you. Only the gospel can change that. The gospel is not something that we achieve. The gospel is something that we receive. It's not a way of life, it's a new life. Because the gospel changes everything. It puts an end to our desperate hunt for validation. And it's not based on our works. It doesn't fluctuate based on the day, the week, the month, the year, the life that you're having, the marriage that you're having, the problems you're having with your kids or the problems you have at work. It doesn't fluctuate on any of that. It's based on Jesus' finished work. And so Paul, what he's saying to Peter is he's saying, in Jesus, God has created a perfect, righteous record for you. Creating a record of righteousness and holiness is not on us. Jesus never invites us to justify ourselves. He fully justifies us. And then he calls us to good works. Friends, only in Jesus can you be fully justified. And when the gospel sinks down deep into you and it becomes a part of who you are, only then will you be able to love. Only then will you be able to live the life that you're called to live. Only then will you be able to help people see the gospel for what it is. And it's that God saves sinners because the gospel changes everything. That's all I have.